Claire Zéon says that this is what is devoted to the recovered transport of migrant women. I have some ideas about the subject, as you may have guessed, but I'm being asked to speak about something rather related, but totally different. This is transport and reshuffling of migrant momentum due to the habitation conflict. Maybe the time, yeah?
Jean-Paul, why don't you put your mic higher up? Might work.
Better?
Maybe you have to hang up the amplifier there.
So tides occur in many objects in this, the protoplanar in this, but I will really focus on the tidal dissipation in the star, enclosed by this, because that's the subject I know better. I began to be interested in that by doing my thesis, and somehow the problem just stuck with me. So I will call the main physical processes which are responsible for that dissipation, and then tell you about the comparison with the observation and mention some latest theoretical development on the subject. So how proceeds the tidal evolution of a binary system? Angular momentum is conserved to first order. If you neglect the mass loss through wind, we can take this into account also, of course, and this has been done. However, the kinetic energy is dissipated in heat through processes that we will examine in a moment. And therefore, the system evolves to its phase of minimum kinetic energy for a given angular momentum. And it's very easy to prove that this is the state where the orbit is circular, but the eccentricity is zero, where all spins are aligned, which means the inclination above the orbit of the rotation axis of the stars is zero. And when the rotation of the stars, planets, are synchronized with the orbital motion. I will call capital omega the rotation rate of the object, and omega orbit that of the orbit. So, how does the tidal torque work? Tidal theory goes back to Galileo, in fact. He had half of the answer. He knew that there would be a bulge on this side because of the centrifugal force, but he had only half of the answer. And we had to wait for Newton, which is gravitational pull, to get a bulge on the other side, and therefore to have, for the Earth, two tides every 24 hours or so. So, we get a tidal bulge because of the differential attraction and the centrifugal force. If there was no dissipation at all, then that tidal bulge would be aligned with the secondary star, which is the Bollandi here, as a point mass. However, when you have dissipation, that means that the tide is not at its highest at the moment where it's really in conjunction with this secondary object. But there's a tidal delay, and therefore the bulge rotates slightly. This is the case where the rotation is faster than the orbital motion, and therefore the delay shifts the bulge in this way. And just by looking at the arrows which pull on each side, this one is a little bigger than this one, you get the intuition that a torque is applied, which tends to slow down the rotation and bring that rotation into co-rotation with the orbital motion here. Of course, everything is exaggerated here. In that picture, the star adjusts immediately to the tidal force, called that the equilibrium tide. You can treat it in hydrostatic equilibrium. And the dissipation, of course, gives that lag angle here, and that angle is a function of the rotational defect, so to speak, so the difference between the rotation rate and the orbital rate. If there is a weak friction, not approximation, but case where this alpha is just a linear function of this difference here. And this occurs, for instance, when just viscosity is at work. In the weak friction approximation, time scales for synchronization and stabilization are given by those expressions here. The relative definition here is the rate at which co-rotation is achieved. We connect here the variation of the orbital velocity, because that changes very slightly only. And you see that this is proportional to the mass ratio between the secondary star and the primary star, of course, the inertia, the moment of inertia is involved also. That depends on the distance as indicated here. R is the radius, A is the separation or the semi-major axis. And there is a constant here, which is split in two, in fact, lambda 2 and Tf. Tf represents the physical mechanism, which is at work. So it gives a time scale, which is characterizes that physical process. And lambda 2 is a function of the distribution of the mass in the star, and also of the dissipation process. If it happens only in the upper layer, but then the lambda 2 reflects that, or if it's in the core, it also does. So this is for the synchronization, and for the circularization, it resembles very much, but of course there is no moment of inertia, the power is slightly different. The difference being in the moment of inertia of the orbit and that of the star. So that's why the time scales are different. And you see this depends also on the rotation rate here, in that limit where alpha, the tidal angle, is just proportional to that difference here. And you see there are cases where when there is one is far from co-rotation, when omega is larger than 18 times the orbital rate, where the eccentricity can actually increase.
So is that first the synchronization that was known to Poincaré?
Oh, I think before, huh?
Before.
Oh yes, yes, yes. Oh yes. There was the bulk of work in the 19th century applied to the Earth, of course. Huh? Oh, I should mention, of course, that in the Earth-Moon system, this has worked very well for the Moon. That's why we see always the same phase of the Moon. But the orbits are not, the spins are not aligned, and of course, we are not circularized by far. There's an eccentricity.
And the reason?
And the reason is just time scale. When you work that out, it's believed that the Moon was viscous at the beginning, when it was. And therefore it really synchronized very fast. Okay, this is the result when you assume that the eccentricity is rather small, so it's to lowest order in eccentricity, and those formulas have been extended to any eccentricity by Hutt not so long ago, it's in 1981, a very nice piece of work. As an example, when you have viscous dissipation, then that ratio is given by this formula here, where you see that which enters the density, of course, the viscosity, and it's the sixth moment with respect to the mass of that quantity here. So this I derived in 66. Alexander gave a formula in 73. We differed by the constant here, and the reason was that we did make different approximations about the velocity field, about the tidal flow. And this was fixed by Charlemagne, in fact, who showed that we had taken approximations which were not really valid, and he took the Bauclinicity into account of those motions, and he gave the correct constant here. So it's really his work which has to be referred to for that the exact expression here. So what are the dissipation processes? The first thing we have to examine is, of course, just microscopic viscosity. When you plug the numbers in, you find, of course, that the time scale is extremely high, and you have to multiply that by this air over ray ratio, which is to some power 6 or 8. So that's absolutely it's much, much too long, of course. But viscosity plays a role if part of the star is turbulent, because then turbulence manufactures smaller scales, and the energy dissipated on the Kolmogorov scale. And in that case, you can work out, can take the same formalism, of course, there's a crude approximation, by just pretending that you have a turbulent viscosity, which is of the order of VL, V being the root mean square, the velocity of the turbulent eddy, say, L, their mean free path. And in that case, when you say that the turbulence comes from the convection, when you have convection zones, then that the friction time is that of the convection, and this is roughly equal to that expression here, which is about 1 year for the sun. See, 10 to the 12 here, 1 year here. And that works, of course. Even though if you multiply by this ratio A over R to some high power, then you get synchronization times and circularization time, which are can be shorter than the lifetime of the star. So this we'll come to that. Pardon me?
Why is the Kelvin
counterpart? Oh, it is not, no. It has nothing to do. The thermal diffusivity does not end in that. When we have convection, then the convective flux is roughly proportional to rho v cubed, you see? And this does not refer to conductivity.
Is the
velocity
of the convection?
Yes. Well, it depends on the height where you are, of course. Near the surface, it's 10 minutes or so. And at the base of the solar convection zone, it's of the order of 20 days or 15.
We have an enormous macroscopic leaping path now.
Yes. Yes, enormous. The mixing length, which we take as a pressure scale height.
They think it confuses between Kepler number and Reynolds number at this point.
Yes.
Granules have a Kepler number already.
The granules have a Kepler number for the one, yes. Yes. But at the base of convection zone, the Kepler number is rather 10 to the 6 or so.
What is it synchronizing with the Earth solution?
No, we are not talking of the Earth here. It's a closed binary. So it's a synchronization of the rotation with the orbital motion, which brings the stars into co-rotation.
Oh, I see. Okay.
No, forgot about the Earth. It was just an illustration. We have stars here. So that works very well for stars which have an outer convection zone, therefore late-type stars on the main sequence, stars on the pre-main sequence, and red giants. It's much less important in stars which have a convective core, and one of the reasons is that the friction time scales like the fractional radius of the convective core to a very high power. And also because the tidal period in that case becomes shorter than the convective turnover time, and this is one of the problems which is nagging the whole subject, and I come back to that. And therefore, you cannot apply this as it is here, because as the eddies travel over a mean free path, they travel over several periods of the tide, and you cannot apply that concept of the eddy viscosity in that case. So now we come to Kelvin-Helmholtz time. And that, of course, is given by this. For the sun, it's about 10 to the 7 years. And when you multiply that again by those ratio A over R to some power, you find it's rather inefficient. And therefore, there must be something else for stars which have an outer radiation zone as an early type star. But I will first concentrate on the equilibrium tide here, which in stars which have a convection zone. So comparison with the observations. When I did my thesis, the only thing we had was data on eclipsing binaries, and that explained why all eclipsing binaries involving late-type stars had circular orbits. There was one exception that is still Alpha Corona Borealis. But it's just by luck that we had eclipses. We happen to be in the plane of the orbits almost, because the period is 17.3 days. So it's the exception which confirms the rule, as we say in French at least. The circularization time that you get when you put the numbers in scales, of course, like this power of the period. And from that, you can work out the period above which the system should still be eccentric and above which the system should be circular. And that scales like that, and for an age of the sun, the period which its formula gives is 6 days. And the first to undertake really a verification of that were Koch and Rivnak in 81. This is the plot they give in their article, where you have the eccentricity and the logarithm of the period. So that corresponds to 10 days here, say, And you see that very roughly there is a change. Here you have almost all stars have a circular orbits, and above this here, which is about 6, 8 or 10 days, you get stars which have any kind of eccentricity. So that was a fair check of that formula here and of the theoretical prediction. It was done later on by, again, by Mayor and Duquesnoy, and they took a very homogeneous sample, which were the stars in the solar neighborhood to some distance from the sun. And again, they get a cutoff period, which is seems to be 10 days here. Here, it's not so well defined. But that depends critically on when you have one star here, you see, because the next one is here. This one would give you a period of 6 days, say, something like that. This one, 10 days. And if just by sheer luck this star was born with zero eccentricity, it would not represent really the cutoff period. Therefore, one has to insist on having very complete samples to define precisely the cutoff period. So the conclusion at that point was that there was a fair agreement with the prediction of that tidal theory. And the most recent work on that, so a very very precise and interesting work, has been done by Ferbund and Finney. They consider the tidal circulation in binaries containing giant stars. So they are very wide binaries. But as they evolve, or at least as one of the components evolves to the red giant branch, it becomes bigger and bigger, and therefore the tidal effects become much larger. And what they do, they follow the variation of the eccentricity just by integrating the inverse of the tidal time, not convection. And what they do, they plot the eccentricity which is observed as a function of this quantity here. When this quantity is of the order of 3 or 4, say, then one would predict that the orbit is circularized. And that this is what is shown, because they plot the logarithm of that quantity, which is already a logarithm, you see. And so 0 corresponds to 1 for this value here, and a factor of 3 would be something like here. So this is eccentricity compared to that. When they plot that, they assume that all those giants are in the helium burning phase, so after having already traveled on the giant branch and had been inflated. And you see there are some exceptions. There is this star here, which departs from the cutoff here. And there are some stars here which are synchronized also. So they address the question of those exceptions. And what they suggest is that this star is not in the helium burning phase, but still climbing on the giant branch. And when they assume that, you see that that star comes here in the graph and fits very well. And for those, they assume that the companion is an evolved star, a white dwarf, say, and therefore that the system has already undergone an inflation, which is completely forgotten now, because that star which has inflated is very small now. And when they do that, then that shifts those three stars completely to the left here. And they get a beautiful picture with a very well-defined cutoff here, just by applying those cute formula, which are based on turbulent viscosity. So that's the best, probably, proof that that mechanism is working. And then one may ask why that prescription is so good. And in my opinion, the reason is that in mixing length theory there are two arbitrary parameters. Alpha, the mixing length parameter, which relates the mixing length to the pressure scale height. And the one which is in that formula, which gives the velocity as a function of the mixing length. Some people take 1/4, Bundy Tense proposes 1/8. So you have really to fix that before you talk about the alpha, because they are related. The convective flux in terms of those constants is given by this expression. Many of you recognize that. And you see, it involves C alpha to the fourth power. And when you calculate the turbulent viscosity, you get this formula here, which involves exactly this, the same combination of the two parameters. And Goff and Weiss in 76 have insisted very much on the fact that what you can determine is that compound, that combination of C and alpha, when you calibrate the convective flux to the observed star like the Sun. And that by changing the C and therefore the alpha, you change some details in the way that you go from the radiative stratification in the atmosphere to the adiabat inside the convection zone. But there are thin, very fine details which do not change the luminosity, the flux, and therefore the radius of the star. So if it's calibrated for the Sun, say, then it should work for the viscosity, and that's probably why that works so well. So the prediction, remember, it was something like 6 days for a solar type star, solar type system. But there was some indication that the cutoff period was higher than that. Let's have a look at that. For instance, this graph showed that it was rather around 10, depending on what weight you give to this star, of course. And for that reason, Mayor and Merlier in 84 made a suggestion that perhaps circularization is achieved already in the image sequence phase. And we wanted to check that with the student. I did that in 89. By just following the evolution of a binary. So you have to give yourself initial conditions. We'll come back to that. And then you, from those initial conditions, you calculate both the velocity of the two components, or you can take equal components, of course, and the evolution of the period. And the complete expression for the circularization is something where I forgot some factors here, but what is important is, of course, that factor here, which shows that the circularization rate is a steep function of the radius. That was the point made by Mayor and Mermillot. But also from these characters here, in the weak friction approximation, those lambdas were just constant. But if one has to reduce them for because the tidal period becomes short compared to the convective turn over time, then all those characters here become themselves functions of here of omega, here of this quantity, here of this quantity, here of this quantity. This is the result that you get when you expand the motion of the star in extended orbit in Fourier components, of course. The Fourier components show up here in those fractions. So by taking one recipe, and I will tell you in a moment which one we took, for the variation of those lambdas as a function of their tidal periods, one gets that result here. So it's a busy graph where the eccentricity is represented here, where the period, the tidal period is represented here, and where the rotation, well, the ratio between the rotation and the orbital frequency is represented by those dashed lines. What you see is that first the co-rotation is not achieved, but that ratio is smaller than the critical 1811. It's even higher than 1811s, and therefore the eccentricity increases first. Then as this becomes circularized, the one corresponds to the circularization here, the eccentricity drops, and most of the circularization takes place between 10 to the 4 and 10 to the 5 or 10 to the 6 years. So that's the main finding here. So as the stars decelerate and come into co-rotation, the angular momentum is transferred from the rotational stars to the orbit, and that explains why the period increases here. And as one approaches the main sequence, then the tidal effects become less important because this has shrunk here and the convection zone has receded to the upper layers. Everything becomes much slower, and that's why the star reaches the main sequence without being in co-rotation, with the rotation being twice or so the tidal frequency here. So from that, and working that out with other binaries with different masses, we come to the conclusion that the cutoff period is between is around 8 days, depending on mass ratios and things like that, compared to 6 days, which was the prediction for the dissipation on the main sequence. And the conclusion was that this is more efficient than main sequence circularization. But that depends critically on how you massage the eddy viscosity. So I come to that problem. How to deal when you have fast tides? Fast meaning that the tidal period is shorter than the convective turnover times. Then obviously you have to do something. You have to reduce the eddy viscosity. So the crudest recipe would be just to forget about that contribution when the tidal period is shorter than the convective turnover time, which means that you consider only the upper layers of the convection zone where this condition is achieved. And then you find that the circularization time is cut by this factor here, where P is the period of the tide, and this is the turnover time of the convection at the base of the convection zone. That's valid for when the convection zone is not too big in that limit. So you can be a bit more clever and not shed all the viscosity away when this condition is fulfilled, but keep only those turbulent eddies which have a turnover time which is shorter than the tidal period. And this was proposed by Goldreich and Killy. Therefore, the viscosity scales like that, V being D lambda and L lambda being the velocity and the mean free pass of the eddies whose turnover time is precisely that of the tidal period. And this scales like the inverse of the convective time to the power 2. So you get a reduction. This is when you have it's not affected by this reduction, and this is the reduction factor which is predicted by this formula here, which depends on the spectrum that you assume. What I did in 66 was much more naive. I said, okay, instead of taking the whole mean free pass of convection, I take only the distance which is traveled by an eddy during a fraction of the period. And that cuts the eddy viscosity just by this, but to power 1, not to power 2. But that makes a big difference, of course. And this recipe has been applied in the graph I have just showed you about the pre-main sequence circularization. I come back to that problem at the end. Yeah? But now, what is happening in stars which have no outer convection zone but a convective core? That they are obviously also circularized and synchronized. But what's going on there is that it's what we call the dynamical tide. There, the tidal potential, which is periodic, excites all eigenmodes which can be excitable. So the gravity modes, the gravito-inertial modes. And since those modes have many nodes in the radial direction, that increases the thermal diffusion of those modes by a factor which is roughly the number of radial nodes to the power 2. And that's what you get for the torque as a function of the period here, when the dissipation time of that particular mode is of the order of the period itself. Then all the resonances merge into each other, and you get some asymptotic behavior on that side for a long period. But
if the gravity is more dense, is that what you're saying?
Pardon me?
In the non-convective stars, is the gravity
modes are damped by radiative dissipation, yes. Yeah. And the shorter the wavelengths of those modes, of course, and the higher the dissipation. Yeah. And you see that each time you undergo a resonance, you have an increase of the tidal torque, and between the resonances, you have, of course, a dip here. And this, of course, as the period becomes shorter and shorter, you feel much the wavelengths of the mode increases, and therefore you have less dissipation, and therefore the effect of the resonances is much higher here. In that regime here, which is often the one which operates, you get those formula for the synchronization time, different powers of R over A. So this was done for gravity waves in 75, and Arlette Rocca has redone the problem by including the effect of rotation to first order, and she came up with something which was very similar, because the radius stretch of the mode is not much affected by the fact that you have the Coriolis force. But that's only true for small rotation rates, and has to be redone for when the rotation rate is of the order of the period. And in the room here, there's someone who is certainly able to do that. So what comes out of that theory here? The prediction is for the circularization that it should occur between 1 and 2.5 days. That's when you use that formula before, and you take as a time the main sequence lifetime of that star. So, and this, those observations have been gathered by Durichin, Mardi Rossan, the N is missing, and Mezzetti in 84. This gives again the eccentricity versus the log of the period here. And you see there's a change of behavior around here, corresponds to log 0.02, which is of the order of predicted here. But there are many systems which are circular here. Have they been born so, and or something else at work? We don't really know.
I'm confused. This is circularization of the envelope, of the radiative envelope.
Exactly. Okay. You're right. Those times have been worked out by assuming that the star is rotating uniformly. And that's not true, of course. Huh? We come to that. Because the torque is applied to where the wave is dissipated, and therefore it's in the outer layers where the dissipation is the highest.
Well, more broadly, I don't understand intuitively why...
So you anticipated one problem which comes here. When you deal with the synchronization of those stars. So that's a little more messy, because what you observe are equatorial velocities, and you have to deproject them because you don't know what the inclination of the star is. And when you compare that with the velocity that they would have if they were in synchronization, and they consider pseudo-synchronization, which means synchronization at the shortest distance from the star in an eccentric orbit, they get that graph here. The zero line is here. This is the logarithm here, because the zero corresponds to synchronization here. And here again, the prediction for the fractional radius in terms of the separation is 0.15, which is here. So that's where you should see, here you should see synchronized stars, and on that side, non-synchronized stars. And there's of course a very strong trend for that synchronization here, shown. But on this side you find stars which have been synchronized, and they are in much wider pairs. And so what is the reason for that? I answered that already. It's because the upper layers are spun down first. And this has been completely elucidated by Goldreich and Nicholson. We have shown that as the upper layers are spun down, the waves are dissipated at the co-rotation radius. So it's really the surface which becomes synchronized first. And then when the gravity waves hit that those surface layer with that rotation rate, then the local frequency, which is Doppler shifted, goes to zero, and therefore the group velocity goes also to zero, and therefore they undergo a very, very strong dissipation. So the star comes into co-rotation like an onion, layer after layer from the surface. I skip that. Just mention that Tassoul was also intrigued by this problem, and to explain that very fast, seemingly, synchronization, he invoked dissipation in the Ekman layers. The Ekman layers, they are those layers which match an implicit solution for the tidal flow with given boundary conditions. They exist, of course. Their thickness is given by that here. Mu is the viscosity and the other numbers you know. That applies to most of the star. In the equatorial region, the power is slightly different. And therefore, Tassoud's claim was that the viscosity equation is enhanced in this layer, and he gave synchronization time, which is this formula here. But Tassoud was wrong, because there are stress-free boundaries applied to the surface, and if you have no stress, you have no dissipation. And therefore, that doesn't work, and when you take this into account, and this was done by Michel Riotor, present here, in 92, then you find that the contribution of the Ekman Taylor is nil. So this mechanism has to be completely ignored. That has not prevented Tassoud from publishing 12 or so papers. In 1997, we wrote another paper just to teach the crowds that it does not work. We gave those drastic examples here. According to Tassoud, Lyo would have synchronized Jupiter because the synchronization time is very short. The extrasolar planet in 51 Pegasus would have synchronized also that star, and this is not observed. In spite of that, poor observers still try to verify Tassoud's mechanism. So, not much time left.
12 papers to 2.
Is this your count? Okay, I just want to mention the recent work on people who have looked at the dynamical type in solar type binaries, so for the radiative core of the star, same phenomenon, same slope, etc. And I had seen those papers, they date 2 years, I had just scanned them slightly 2 years ago. When I was preparing that talk, I was puzzled by the results, and I think they are correct in the principle, but they are off by a very serious factor here. But let's take them at face value here. In that case, their claim is that it's of the same efficiency as the turbulent viscosity dissipation, but in that case it would not explain either the main sequence circularization. So I have to check that more carefully. And I come back to what is really the outstanding problem, and with this brings us back to topic of the session here, which is about turbulence. What can we do when we have a fast tide, when the convective, when the tidal period is shorter than the convective time? There's a recent work by Goodman and O here in 1997, which is the first one which addresses that problem in a serious way. And what I found is that the eddy viscosity scales, as I had indicated, but that it becomes imaginary. Therefore, that the Reynolds stress is in quadrature of what it should be when you have an eddy viscosity. And if I have just 2 minutes more, I will tell you crudely where the problem is. When you take Euler's equation here, with tidal forcing, we suppose that tidal forcing would induce a shear in the vertical direction of and that velocity induced by that is horizontal, and a shear in the vertical direction. And I split the velocity into the mean flow, which is the tidal flow, plus, say, the turbulent velocity here. When you massage that, taking horizontal arrows and things like that, you find that for the mean flow is given by this expression here, which involves the Reynolds stress averaged over horizontal here. For the turbulent flow, you get those formula here. And therefore, for the derivative of the Reynolds stress, you have this formula here, which relates the Reynolds stress to the shear rate of the mean flow here. When you, in the limit of a long tidal period, you can integrate that equation over correlation time of the convection, and you come out with the usual prescription for the eddy viscosity, which is what I've given before, velocity times the length. But for short tidal period, you can integrate, because F and U vary periodically as with the tidal frequency here. The Reynolds stress average is given by this formula here, where you have the imaginary part here. And therefore, the turbulent viscosity is given by usual expression here, times the reduction factor, which I had suggested, but with that nasty imaginary part here. So the question is really, and this has not been solved yet, how does one go smoothly from that formula here to this one? What is the intermediate regime? And this is something which has to be solved. Okay, so I finish just by that. What needs to be done, in my opinion, I think the time has come where we could perform numerical simulations of tidal forcing and convection. Just putting a tidal force into a program, a code of three-dimensional convection, as turbulent as possible, and see what the reaction is. Something which has to be really done also is to treat correctly the effect of the Coriolis force on the mode, because it's not of order epsilon, it's really of order one. And of course, to refine those cutoff periods by gathering more observational data. Thank you.
We have 4 minutes of question time.
For starters, very thin outer convective zones, do you use those? The question, I guess my question is, how do you split up the interior for those? So for a late F star?
For G stars, it still works, huh, because you have a convection zone. But then it fades away, and that equilibrium type with the turbulent dissipation doesn't work. Except on the pre-main sequence. I had not the time to show that, but let me show it. That's a very recent result, 2000, which shows the behavior of AM stars, binaries, in the rather young clusters, Preserve and Hyades. And those, according to what we know about what's happening on the main sequence, should not be circularized at all. And they are, with a cutoff period which is of the order of 10 days or so, which is an indication that they have been circularized on the pre-main sequence.
Helen?
Can you comment on whether disks in pre-main sequence binaries are important in the afternoon?
They will probably fix what I call the boundary, the initial conditions. Which I have not thought about that. When you do that kind of calculation, you need initial conditions, and it's very crucial what radius you take at that time and what velocity.
But it's not just an initial condition, because they could soak up a lot of angular momentum.
That's right. That's right. But you see, they certainly do, because we have to get rid of that, of most of it. But we start the calculations, they don't depend very much on the rotation that you assume at the beginning. We played with omega, which was three times larger than the orbital wind, or less. It doesn't depend very much on that.
It's kind of a crazy idea, but if two stars share some magnetic field line, start winding up.
Certainly, yes. But I think nobody has. It was Leon's idea, yeah? But you have not worked that out, I think, no?
That's my obsession with magnetism.
What do you say?
My obsession with magnetism. Yeah.
I just wondered if you could help me with the understanding of this imaginary viscosity. You have them to make the velocity complex.
No, it's just the forcing is periodic.
Yeah.
And therefore there is a time lag when you integrate.
Yes, but I mean, how do you, when you say imaginary viscosity, you put that equation, how do you...
It will just change the response, but it will not give a dissipating term.
Yes,
it will,
the Schrodinger question.
Yes.
The Schrodinger question, the field is complex, and I don't understand what...
It's only the real part of that Reynolds stress tensor.
So you have a real part condition.
Yeah. No, what I showed is that in that limit, at least by those crude arguments, there is no real part at all. In the extreme limit, yes. But probably you go smoothly from a real value to that completely imaginary one, and that transition from one to the other has not been described yet.
As an early
advocate of tacit science for an object like the sun,
yes,
and the possibility that there's some magnetism, how would that change the story of your tidal dissipation? You do things in convection zones rapidly, and then you somehow couple to a much deeper core.
Something which is completely swept under the rug is the coupling between the region which is slowed down or in correlation with the rest. If we master that, if we understand better the tidal mechanism, then we would have constraints on the transport between those two regions. That would be very, very helpful. So that would be a diagnostic of that kind of transport. You're right, this is not considered at all here.
These calculations seem very relevant to the new extrasolar planets that are being discovered, some of which are very large and close to the star. Have you thought about that problem?
Yes, I just mentioned the case of 51 Pegasus, you see. And it works very well. Most of those, of the stars which have planets, they are solar type stars, and therefore the convective tide applies very well there.
One last question, sorry.
Which what you say? Yes, yes.
Works so poorly when one tries to understand the differential rotation, large scale differential rotation.
No. Well, it's a point that Yuri mentioned yesterday. Yeah. Clearly, to assume that you have just a diffusive turbine medium for the convection zone is a very poor approximation. And for that reason, I plead to have really calculations made which take into account also the advective nature of those plumes in a convection zone. This is completely clouded by that treatment. And that's crucial probably to give you the right differential rotation that we see in the convection zone.
Thank you, John. Let's move on to the next contribution. Thank you.